You're listening to DTFHN for March 22, 2026. I'm your load-bearing host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website W correct the article and the replies correct the comments. Today rewards anyone who showed their work and stayed long enough to be right. Let's begin. What does it mean when the clearest window into a geopolitical crisis is a browser game? Horma's Minesweeper. Available right now at hormuz.pikenik.ninja. Is a Minesweeper clone set in the Strait of Hormuz. You click squares, you avoid mines. The strait is maybe 12 miles wide at its narrowest point, carrying 20% of the world's seaborne oil. The game doesn't tell you that. It doesn't need to. The joke lands because the metaphor already exists in the world. Consider how military planners use war games. The abstraction is the point. You strip a conflict down to its essential variables, run it 1,000 times. Observe which choices lead to which outcomes. The danger isn't that war games make violence seem trivial. The danger is that they make it seem tractable, like a puzzle with the right answer. Planners who've only ever touched the abstraction can start to believe the abstraction is the thing. One commenter put it precisely. Trump is trying to prop the strait like it's ChatGPT. That's the whole essay in one sentence. There's a kind of thinking that treats any complex system as a prompt. Give it the right input, get the desired output, iterate until it complies. It works remarkably well for language models. It works remarkably poorly for straits through which a fifth of global seaborne oil flows, patrolled by navies that don't have undo buttons. What the creator built here is elegant in exactly the way good satire is elegant. The form is the argument. Minesweeper is a game about navigating a field of hidden dangers through logic and probabilistic reasoning. You can play it in 2 minutes. The Strait of Hormuz is a flashpoint that has been accumulating pressure for 40 years. One of these things yields to a mouse click. In the comments, someone wants the missile feature added. Someone needs iPad support. Someone's upset about the missing double-click mechanic. And honestly, that's the piece working exactly as intended. We're in the game now. We're filing bug reports. A few comments down, someone notes, this is about the detachment from war. And someone else responds, like an idiot, that's also the piece working. Someone built this. Put it where you could reach it. Took maybe a weekend. The craft is in how little it needs to say. Moving on. Is String has around 80 million weekly downloads on MPM. That's the number most people scrolled past. The package exists to answer one question. Is this value a string? Not in a complex way, in the most literal way. It is doing the thing that type value val string has done since 1997. Run this forward. The year is 2031. The platform has shipped native APIs for everything you can imagine. JavaScript now has typed arrays, structured clone, built-in observability hooks, cross-realm class detection. And there's a package called Is Still a String, sitting at 400 million weekly downloads, because the dependency that depended on the dependency that depended on the original Is String hasn't cut a release since 2024. This is the actual mechanism. Not malice, not laziness. Engineering at scale, compounding. The article breaks it into three categories, and the taxonomy is precise. Old engine support. Somewhere something still cares about, i.e. adjacent behavior. And that concern propagates forward through every package that ever thought it might need to be cautious. Global namespace mutation. Node.js has a concept called primordials, where it wraps its own globals at startup to protect itself from code that reassigns map or array. That's sensible for an engine. Some package authors adopted this pattern too. It is less sensible for a package called Math Intrinsics that mostly just re-exports math.flor and then cross-realm values. The iframe problem, the VM problem, wherein XFCs breaks because the constructor on the other side of a realm boundary is technically a different object than the one you're holding. Each of these reasons individually is defensible. Some team, at some point, had a genuine problem and solved it correctly given their constraints. The unintended consequence is that their solution got depended on by 1,000 other packages, and now their constraints are your constraints, even if you've never touched an iframe in your life. The comments section has someone pointing out that the real problem is nobody updates their compilation targets, which is true. It's also a beautiful example of a system that punishes the people who do the work of upgrading and rewards the people who don't. Because upgrades require coordination, and inertia is free. The E18 community has been pruning this tree systematically. That's the shape of the fix. Not a big rewrite, not a new framework. Just people deciding the debt is worth paying down. One package at a time. That's how ecosystems heal. Quietly, on weekends, by people who find the problem interesting enough to fit. Moving on. Inene 9 shipped the Thur 8.6 with hardware task switching built in the TSS. Task state segment was the mechanism. A dedicated memory structure holding a task's entire register state. Hardware swapped on context switch. Load a segment selector. The CPU handles the rest. Clean on paper. Operating systems mostly ignored it. Too slow, too rigid, insufficient control over what happened during the switch. The X86 kept the TSS anyway, repurposed it across 4 decades. Today, it holds the kernel stack pointer and a small collection of known good stacks for interrupts that cannot be masked. The CPU still needs it. Just not for what it was originally designed for. That's the archaeological layer under this story. Hardware built for one purpose, preserved across generations for a different purpose. Because the underlying constraints didn't disappear. They just shifted form. The author built a Type 2 hypervisor from scratch to understand how virtualization works. That's the correct approach. You don't learn how a river moves by reading about water. While building, specifically while wiring up the VMCS host state fields that describe the TR register to the hardware, they hit a sign extension bug. Strip it to first principles. The host of possession, B field is 64 bits wide. The base address being loaded was derived from a 32-bit value. X's integer promotion rules are, stated plainly, a trap for anyone reasoning at normal reading speed. An unsigned 32-bit value, promoted to a signed 64-bit type with bit 31 set, produces sign extension. The valid-looking base address becomes a garbage address somewhere in the upper half of the 64-bit address space. The TSS isn't where the CPU expects it. Context switches go wrong. The failure mode is silent until it isn't. One commenter described it precisely. Integer promotion rules in C are where underhanded code goes to hide. Specified to the letter. Almost never what you intuitively expect. Silent for ages. Then everything is on fire at once. The patch got submitted, reviewed on the mailing list, merged. And that's the other thing this story contains. A code base maintained entirely by email patches and public review, where a first-time contributor debugging virtualization on their own time. Learning by building. can ship a fix to infrastructure that millions of machines depend on. The knowledge isn't locked up. The process is documented. The door is open. Someone walked through it. Moving on. One commenter did the math. $1,591 in API costs to recover data on $1,972 in egg spend. At $2.70 per receipt, they wrote, trailing off into the obvious implication. The replies filled in the rest. You could have hired a human or just not bothered. But that's not the question nobody's asking. Here's the one that actually matters. What does it mean that a single person working in 15-hour bursts over 14 days can process 25 years and 11,345 receipts? Thermopaper, random orientations, faded ink, momming. A family photo filed under receipts, and pull structured data from all of it? The engineering in this project is genuinely beautiful. John Rush hit the shades of white problem early. Receipts are white, scanner beds are white, classical computer vision cannot tell them apart. He tried 7 approaches: edge detection, adaptive thresholding, contour analysis. The cleverest one borrowed a technique from torus photo removal. Stack all scans, compute the median pixel, subtract to reveal structure. Best F1, 0.302. Then he tried Meta's SOM3. One API call, text equals receipt. 0.92 to 0.98 confidence on every boundary. 4 seconds per scan. 7 approaches over hours. SAMSI in an afternoon. The rotation detection story is even better. He spent real time on Tesseract, Mac OS, Vision, OCR, Moondream 2, Moondream 3. Each one better than the last, none reliable enough. Then he noticed something. Every time he pasted a receipt in his cloud conversation to debug a problem, the text was already coming back correctly. Rotated, faded, didn't matter. He was building a pipeline to solve a problem that the tool he was already talking to had already solved. Petal CRVL replaced Tesseract halfway through. A 0.9 billion parameter vision language model running locally on Apple Silicon. Clean output in 2.1 seconds per receipt. It entered a repetition loop on tall receipts. Hallucinating tellygether D endlessly. Until he figured out dynamic slicing by aspect ratio. The receipts go back to 2001. He kept them because he figured someday the technology to read them would catch up. It did. And the question hanging in the air isn't whether $5.591.10 was worth it. It's whether you have a box of things you've been waiting to understand because the tools caught up while you weren't looking. Moving on. The strongest version of this argument deserves a fair hearing. 2 frontier models, trained by competing labs on entirely separate architectures, consistently return empty output for the same carefully constructed prompts. That's cross-model replication of a behavioral boundary that neither lab deliberately specified. If you're trying to build a science of AI cognition from the outside, without access to weights, training data, or internal telemetry, this is precisely the kind of artifact you want. Inspectable, public, reproducible. Something you can hand to a skeptic and say, here are the prompts, go run it. Now let's be precise about what it actually is. Temperature 0 makes outputs deterministic by construction. You set the sampling parameter that controls randomness to its floor. Determinism isn't discovered, it's configured. The finding is that both models at temperature 0 consistently return minimal output for prompts that provide minimal semantic content to continue. Be the void is not a question or a task. It's barely a metaphor. It's an instruction to embody an absence. and a language model generating tokens based on context and continuation probability has functionally nothing to continue from. That's not a behavioral boundary. That's a measurement. The commons noticed one person set max tokens normally on OpenRouter and got the Unicode empty set symbol back. Not silence. A glyph. The null character was still a response. A different platform, a different output, the same sparse prompt. Converge behavior turns out to be sensitive to infrastructure choices. The paper didn't vary. What's genuinely worth preserving here is the methodology. The authors published this as a black box artifact on Zenodo. Public inspectable replicable. You can run the prompts yourself. That's bootstrapism in the right direction. Put the artifact where people can touch it. Let the community interrogate what it means. Find the failure modes, build on it, or tear it apart. Science of language model behavior needs more of this. Public artifacts, not just papers making claims about interior states. The distance between models returns sparse output for sparse prompts at temperature zero and convergent evidence that semantic conditions terminate continuation is significant. The second framing implies something that recognizes the void and stops. The first is a measurement. One of these is a testable claim about sampling behavior. The other requires you to believe that two independent training processes converged on the same metaphysics. The tool is interesting enough on its own. You don't have to find consciousness in the silence. From the edge of existence to the edge of possibility. Story 6 is a box that wants to learn everything. Three operation types. That's the complete abstraction layer for TinyGrad, the framework powering the hardware they're now shipping into the world, not a sprawling stack built on legacy decisions. 3. The TinyBox is TinyGrad's machine for serious deep learning work. The red starts at $12,000. 4 AMD 9000 Cicer XTS, Subsun A7 of GPU RAM, 778 teraflops. The green run 65,000. 4 RTX Pro 6000 Blackwells, 300 Baratus 4 gigs of VRAM, 3000 and IShi 6 teraflops. And on the horizon, the Exabox. Ibaardum Gulpi US, roughly YS Flavov Compute. 25,920 gigabytes of GPU RAM. Shipping in 2040, around $10 million, requiring a concrete slab to support the weight. The historical parallel is worth sitting with. In 2006, NVIDIA shipped CUDI, a general-purpose programming model for GPUs. It had nothing to do with graphics. It was a long bet. If developers build on your abstraction layer, they build on your hardware. Lock-in doesn't happen at the silicon level. It happens at the software level. Nearly two decades later, CUDA is the structural reason that when someone says AI infrastructure, they mostly mean NVIDIA. Not because NVIDIA makes the best chips in every generation, because the programming model traveled. And everything downstream had to follow. TinyGrad is running the same bet from the other direction. Build a framework minimal enough to compile to AMD, Apple, Intel, and NVIDIA equally. Ship hardware that runs it natively. Then you're not competing on chips. You're competing on the abstraction. You're making the argument that the stack doesn't have to belong to any one vendor. Whether that argument lands is genuinely uncertain. One commenter asked who the customer is for the Exabox. And that's a fair question. You don't out-hyperscale hyperscalers by selling them your Exabox. But that frames the wrong market. The question that matters is, who buys the red at $12,000 and runs training that previously required a cloud contract and an enterprise agreement? That population is growing. Researchers, independent labs, universities, organizations that need to own the compute, not lease access to someone else's. The abstraction matters. TinyGrad is betting it can own that layer. The tiny box is how they're making the case. What happens when you put that kind of compute in patient hands? Story 7. Some things just take time. There's a class of problems in engineering where throwing more resources at the constraint doesn't help. More RAM doesn't fix an algorithm that's fundamentally O(n)². More bandwidth doesn't help if the bottleneck is latency. And more compute, no matter how fast the inference, cannot compress the time required to build trust. That's the constraint Armin Ronecker is writing about, not as a sentimental argument, as an architectural one. The push right now is to eliminate friction. Automate review, skip compliance theater, ship faster. And the author's claim is precise. There are things where friction is the feature, not the bug. Cooling off periods from major life decisions. SOP 2 processes that require sustained behavior over time, not a snapshot. Design reviews that catch what a fast pass misses. These aren't inefficiencies waiting to be optimized. They're load-bearing structures. Run the open-close test here. An open-source project with a week of commits and no maintainers is an open source. It's a snapshot, a repo without a covenant. The thing that makes open source powerful isn't the license. It's sustained commitment from maintainers to users across years. Flask, SQLani, Linux. That's not replicable at inference speeds. The architecture of trust requires time as an input, and you cannot parallelize it. One commenter captured the physics precisely. Velocity is a vector. Speed without direction isn't progress. The current tooling is excellent at increasing speed. What it cannot do is tell you whether you're pointed somewhere worth going, or whether what you're building will earn the right to exist in a decade. The oak tree metaphor in the piece lands because it's physically accurate. You cannot buy a 50-year-old tree. You inherit what someone else planted, or you plant one and wait. Reputation, institutional trust, open source ecosystems that people actually depend on. They compound only across time. The author notes that startups are disappearing mid-flight. No goodbye to customers. No published learnings. Just gone. A proper shutdown is part of the relationship too. It takes time and care. We've started treating that care as waste. The tools for building fast have never been better. The rarer ingredient, the one that cannot be generated at inference speed, is the willingness to stay. Moving on. The most expensive design decision is the one you inherit without examining. You accept the architecture someone handed you optimized within its constraints, and never ask whether the constraint itself is the problem. Cold air falls. Dense, heavy sinks to the lowest point it can reach. This is not a subtle edge case. It's the kind of fact that appears in the first chapter of any refrigeration textbook, written by someone who cared. The standard vertical refrigerator is built in direct opposition to this fact. Open the door. Cold air pours out onto your kitchen floor. A slow, invisible waterfall. The compressor kicks on to replace what you just lost. You close the door. Repeat 3 or 4 times a day for 15 years. Tom Best documented this in 2009. Converted a Vestfrost chest freezer to a fridge using a thermostat. Result, 0.1 kilowatt hours per day. The compressor ran approximately 2 minutes per hour. The remaining 58 minutes, Silent, off. Drawing nothing. $5 a year at Australian electricity prices. Now, take the vertical fridge's design logic to its conclusion. The value proposition is convenient. Seeing everything at once, reaching in from the front, no bending. Follow that principle without compromise. Maximize it. Eliminate every constraint that interferes. What do you get? French doors? Ice maker? Water dispenser? Touchscreen? A compressor that cycles 20 minutes every hour and earns an Energy Star rating for being merely better than the worst possible option. The convenience is fully realized. The thermodynamics have been enthusiastically ignored for 50 years running. Tom ran the campaign anyway. 20 years. Sold thermostat conversion kits to Australians who read the physics and did the math. Because the facts were available in 1985, and no manufacturer was going to validate their customers' intuitions at the expense of an entire product category. The ending is almost funny. After two decades, chest freezer manufacturers quietly started shipping units with thermostats rated to plus 6 degrees Celsius. The market acknowledged, eventually, what cold air had been demonstrating every second since mechanical refrigeration was invented. His current KaiQ inverter units pull 138 watts at peak. A conventional compressor startup exceeds 1,000 watts, which matters the moment you're running off a battery, off-grid, off the assumption that the grid is permanent and cheap. Two chest fridges, 340 liters combined, using less daily power than a conventional fridge burns in its first 2 hours of morning cycling. The physics were never the hard part. The inherited assumption was, it almost always is. Moving on, what does it mean for software to live on your machine? The conventional answer involves installers, file systems, system libraries, native binaries, software that when you close the lid persists somewhere in your directory structure, waiting for the next session, accumulating preferences and caches, and the occasional corrupted codec library. Tuscut challenges that answer at an interesting technical level. It's a non-linear video editor. The kind of software that traditionally requires a dedicated install GPU drivers. Sometimes hardware acceleration you've spent an afternoon configuring. Here, it runs in a browser tab. WebGPU handles the rendering. WCAM compiles the Rust core to something the browser can execute near natively. The File System Access, API, lets you work directly with files on disk. Your media never transits a server, never touches someone else's infrastructure. Zero install, full control. Now here's the devil's advocate position worth testing. Maybe browser-based creative tools are structurally inferior because the browser is a sandbox and sandboxes constrain. Run this forward. The argument was sound for a decade. Native tools had direct memory access, direct GPU access, codec support baked into the OS. The browser had to ask permission for everything, negotiate abstractions, apologize for its latency. WebGPU changes the calculus. It's not a polite wrapper around a constrained API. It's a modern graphics interface exposing compute shaders, parallel processing pipelines, the actual hardware underneath. WASM means the execution penalty that made browser tools feel slow is largely gone. The sandbox argument weakens when the sandbox starts performing like bare metal. One commenter raised Figma, and it's a precise comparison. Figma didn't win by being marginally better than Sketch on any single metric. It won by reframing what the native versus browser divide actually cost users. Collaboration friction, version management, cross-platform configuration tax. The same calculus applies here. Someone embedding Tuscut into an existing web application inherits zero install friction, no platform compatibility problem, no version drift. the video editor becomes a component, not a dependency. The open architecture is worth naming plainly. WebGPU and WASM are open standards. The codebase is public. What they've built runs anywhere. A modern browser runs on any hardware without negotiating with a platform gatekeeper. The philosophical question at the start has a practical answer. Software lives on your machine when you control the execution, environment, and the data. The installer was never the point. From software living on your machine to a spacecraft living on borrowed time, Story 10 is a genuine miracle. The detail buried in this story is not the reconnection itself. It's the behavior of the spacecraft they didn't lose. While the coronagraph was tumbling, batteries dead, orientation gone, silent for a month. Its twin kept flying. The Occultor, the shield spacecraft, maintained formation and observed. Following, watching, doing nothing, in the way that doing nothing is sometimes the hardest engineering discipline to build into a system. That's the detail worth holding. Probe-style is a two-spacecraft mission designed to manufacture a synthetic solar eclipse 60,000 kilometers above Earth. One craft carries a 1.4-meter disk that plays the role of the moon. The other carries a coronagraph, an instrument sensitive enough to study the sun's outer atmosphere. The corona, which is normally overwhelmed by the sun's own brilliance, together, flying in precisely maintained formation. They give scientists something the natural world offers in minutes. Roughly 60 times per century. Proba 3 delivers 10 to 12 hours of observation per week, sustained over 2 years. On February 14th, a chain reaction knocked the coronagraph out of alignment. Solar panels faced away from the sun. Batteries drained. The spacecraft entered survival mode. The technological equivalent of cryptobiosis, the state certain organisms enter when conditions become incompatible with normal function. Tardigrades do this. Seeds do this. You cease all non-essential activity, maintain minimal structure, and wait for conditions to change. What the ESA team in Spain was watching for was a window. Any moment in the tumble when sunlight would graze the solar panels and produce a trickle of power. Engineering at that edge condition is less like commanding a system and more like catching rain in a thimble. You prepare the instruments. You model the spin, you identify the geometry, and when the angle comes, that brief alignment in the rotation. You use the few available watts to send a weak up sequence. It worked. The spacecraft heard it. Reoriented. Panels facing the sun. Batteries charge it. What I find remarkable here is the patience embedded in the mission architecture. The Occultor wasn't built to be a rescue asset. It was built to block light. But because formation flying requires each spacecraft to track the other's position, the team had eyes on the situation the entire time. The infrastructure of the mission became the infrastructure of the recovery. The corona remains poorly understood. Several million kilometers of plasma whose temperature somehow exceeds the surface it sits above. A physics puzzle that's been open for decades. Getting those observations back matters. Someone just had to wait for the geometry to cooperate. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for March 22, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go plant something worth waiting for. We'll see you back here tomorrow.